welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, October the 12th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for today. Today, we're experiencing a chance of morning showers, and it'll be windy, winds from the northwest at 15 to 30 miles per hour. Cedar Rapids will see a high of 67 and will climb to 68 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low this evening of 46 in Cedar Rapids and 47 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 6:30 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow at 7:17 a.m. for a total daylight period of 14 hours and 14 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, older voters are driving early Iowa voting, a story by James Q. Lynch of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. The generation that led change on college campuses, in social life, the workplace, and definitely in politics, is poised to make its presence felt again at the ballot box. That's because the radicals and revolutionaries of the 60s and 70s have aged into the demographic cohort with the heaviest turnout on election day. One of the things I learned way back in about the Carter era was just a rule of thumb that 20% of 20-year-olds, 30% of 30-year-olds, and so on until you get to 80% of 80-year-olds vote, said Roe Fogey of Cedar Rapids, a Democrat who formerly represented the Mount Vernon area in the Iowa House. In the 2016 general election, 80% of Iowa registered voters aged 50 to 64 and 83% of those aged 65 and older cast ballots. Only 9% of voters age 18 to 24 participated in the election, according to the Iowa Secretary of State. Overall, Iowans 50 and older accounted for 55% of the vote. Based on voter registration and absentee ballot request numbers, he's seeing from older voters, AARP Iowa State Director Brad Anderson wrote a memo about the 2020 election headlined, "It's all about 65-plus voters." Exit polls 4 years ago found that Donald Trump won 65-plus voters by 4 percentage points. A September poll conducted for the AARP Iowa showed Trump leading former Vice President Joe Biden among voters aged 50 to 64 by 22 points, 59% to 37%. However, the president trailed Biden 38 to 55% among 65-plus voters. If this is a change election, the change will be brought by 65-plus voters, Anderson said. If it's a status quo election, those voters will return home. Either way, Anderson said the outcome of the presidential race is likely in the hands of 65-plus voters in battleground states. In that case, he said, candidates need to pay attention to the large number of older voters and their concerns. There are three, according to Tony Vola, age 73, a Republican and former president of the AARP Iowa board. First, don't mess with my Social Security, don't mess up Medicare, and support policies that help me stay in my home as long as I can, said Vola, who returned to Iowa and started an in-home care business after a military career. If 1992 was "it's the economy, stupid," this election is "it's the virus, but don't forget about Social Security," Anderson said. COVID-19 is driving the increased number of absentee ballot requests across all age groups. However, nearly 70% of the more than 630,000 absentee ballot requests have come from voters 50 and older. That's no surprise to Fogey, age 82, a member of AARP Iowa's executive board. Based on his observations, younger people seem pretty nonchalant about COVID-19. But to those of us over 65, COVID-19 is a lot scarier. The combination of the virus and concerns of people in his age group who depend on Social Security makes Fogey think Anderson's assessment is right, that my age group could be the one that tips the scales. Vola, who said he hasn't missed an election since reaching voting age, isn't sure whether older voters are establishing the change or pushing the change. I still think older voters are fairly quiet when it comes to how they approach things, he said. They're not loud and boisterous and out in the street and that sort of stuff. They just do what they need to do. This year, he and Foggy agree they need and want to vote, and COVID-19 is driving them to absentee voting. I think there's still a lot of people, whatever age, who would really like to go to the polls and vote at the machine in their neighborhood polling place, Foggy said. But I think the older you are, the more of a threat it is to you. All of the statistics show that we're more vulnerable than younger people. Vola agrees, but plans to vote in person. Seniors want to vote, and they're going to find the safest way, Vola said. Some are concerned about showing up, so they're going to go absentees. People like me aren't afraid to walk in the door, so I'm going to walk in the door. Voters can continue to request absentee ballots until October 24th, and early in-person voting continues until November 2, and Election Day is November 3. And in today's virus news, 1 in 5 virus tests in Iowa prove positive, a story by John McLaughlin of the Gazette staff. The rate of Iowans testing positive for COVID-19 rose Sunday morning to the highest level in more than 2 weeks as the state reported 1,262 new cases and 6 more deaths. Of the 6,237 test results that came back in a 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Sunday, 4,975 of them proved negative or inconclusive. That means the rate of those that were positive, 20.23%, is the highest since a 20.54 positivity rate on September 17. Linn County added 47 cases and Johnson County 14. The new results bring the total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Iowa to 99,620. Crawford, Linn, Poweshiek, Tama, Wapello, and Woodbury counties each reported a death as a result of the virus, bringing the state's total COVID-19 death count to 1,460 so far. Among children who are of school age up to 17 years old, another 142 cases were recorded, for a total of 8,567 in that age group. For those listed by the state in the education occupation category, Iowa added 72 cases in the 24-hour period for a total of 4,647. Statewide, hospitalizations because of COVID-19 stepped down from 450 to 438 during the period. Patients in intensive care dropped by 1 to 100, and those on ventilators remained at 40. The 10 counties that have reported the most cases since the pandemic began are Polk County at 17,148, Woodbury County at 6,349, Johnson County at 5,447, Black Hawk County at 4,912, Linn County at 4,664, Dubuque County at 4,146, Story County at 3,709, and Scott County at 3,572, Dallas County at 3,101, and Pottawatomie County, 2,649. Also from today's front page, drunken driving is down in Iowa, but will it last? An article by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette staff from Iowa City. Liquor sales surged at the beginning of the pandemic, but Iowans apparently are choosing to do their drinking while staying at home and not getting behind the wheel. According to data from the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Planning, a division within the Iowa Department of Human Rights, drunken driving cases have dropped off significantly this year. Using information from the judicial branch's case management system, the report shows there were 6,559 drunken driving charges, including operating boats and ATVs under the influence between March 15 and September 15 last year. During that same period this year, there were 4,383, a 33% drop. That jibes with a 21% decrease in vehicle traffic across Iowa during that time, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. For corridor police departments, it's not hard to see where the drop in charges is coming from. It's the pandemic, said Iowa City Police Captain Denise Brotherton. Back in March, when everything shut down, Iowa City was like a ghost town. Brotherton said that with bars and restaurants closed, offering only carryout or operating at reduced capacity, there simply were fewer places for people to go for an adult beverage. You couldn't go to a bar, Brotherton said. You couldn't go to a restaurant. You could basically buy your alcohol and go home. The drop-off in drunken driving arrests was particularly dramatic in Iowa City. Data shows 298 arrests from March 15 to September 12, 2019, but only 71 from that same period this year. Cedar Rapids also saw a decrease in drunken driving arrests this year, though not as significant. During the same time period, there were 225 drunken driving arrests in 2019 and 175 this year. People just weren't out and about as much, said Cedar Rapids Police Sergeant Graham Campshore. Not only were bars and restaurants closed, but Cedar Rapids is home to numerous entertainment and sporting venues that were closed much of the year, including the U.S. Cellular Center, McGrath Amphitheater, and Veterans Memorial Stadium. That meant no concerts, no plays or musicals, and no Colonels baseball. Those are all events where people are consuming alcohol, Campshore said. Iowa State Patrol Lieutenant Nathan Ludwig, however, said troopers haven't seen a significant decrease in drunken driving across the state. There were 740 drunken driving arrests by troopers between March 15 and September 12, 2019, and 708 in that time this year. We saw a reduction in traffic big time in April and May, Ludwig said. But once the state started opening back up, traffic volume increased as well, and so did fatalities, Ludwig said. In July and August, we saw a big jump in fatalities, he said. Iowa saw 14 traffic fatalities in March and 17 in April, Iowa DOT data show, but then 44 in July, 51 in August, and 39 in September. As of Friday, there have been 255 traffic fatalities in Iowa this year, up 3 from the same period in 2019. After many jurisdictions saw the dip in drunken driving arrests, there are signs they could be picking back up. Brotherton said at the onset of the pandemic, officers were advised to conduct traffic stops only for major safety issues. That changed when the University of Iowa students returned in late August for fall classes, she said. We noticed as things started to open back up and students came back, we had to start doing traffic enforcement again, Brotherton said. It wasn't safe. Speeds were up. We needed to get back on this before we had a major problem and someone got seriously hurt. Turning to today's opinion page, we have a guest column written by Doug Durante and Doug Somke. Doug Durante is the executive director of the Clean Fuels Development Coalition, and Doug Somke is president of the South Dakota Farmers Union and a fourth-generation crop and livestock farmer. And their article is entitled A Larger Market for Iowa Ethanol. It was just over 2 months ago when the powerful derecho sent intense winds and thunderstorms over a 700-mile stretch from Nebraska to Indiana, causing catastrophic damage. In Iowa, more than 40% of the corn and soybean crop was severely damaged by the storm. The overall destruction to homes, farms, and businesses has been estimated to reach $4 billion. There also will be long-term effects, including more flooding and poorer air quality due to the extensive loss of trees. However, there is good news. There still are significant corn supplies that could help speed the recovery through not just processing it to ethanol, but ramping up production to achieve higher blends than typically used. In doing so, we can not only help ourselves, but we produce cleaner fuel that will help urban pollution and potentially the spread of the coronavirus. Respected political leaders have endorsed the benefit of using ethanol in much higher volumes than we are now using as an aromatics replacement. Last year, Senator Chuck Grassley and former Senator Tim Worth wrote in a bipartisan message that the use of higher ethanol blends is part of the solution to the nation's energy and climate challenges. Recently, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem of the Governor's Biofuels Coalition wrote to President Donald Trump requesting that he direct the Environmental Protection Agency to reduce the use of toxic aromatics as the Clean Air Act directs by substituting high-octane ethanol. For more than 30 years, regulators have failed to control these toxic ultrafine particles, or UFPs, from gasoline emissions. This lethal pollutant, invisible to the naked eye, is a primary cause of preterm births, childhood asthma, cardiovascular disease, and a wide range of cancers. It took almost three decades for lead, an octane booster, to be removed from gasoline because it was a poison. By the time Congress finally banned lead in the 1990 Clean Air Act, new health threats had emerged as refiners were replacing a poison with a toxic carcinogen, oil-derived octane boosters called aromatics. So Congress overwhelmingly voted to require EPA to replace aromatics as soon as safe substitutes became available. Today, 30 years later, this important requirement to protect our health continues to be ignored. Currently, 25% of the 140 billion gallons of gasoline consumed in the United States contains carcinogenic aromatics. As an aromatics substitute, high-octane ethanol is safe, reduces carbon emissions, is environmentally friendly, and cost-effective. While Iowans are aware of the economic impact from the ethanol industry, imagine the benefits of doubling or tripling that impact through higher blends. Adding 20% more ethanol to today's 10% blend could reduce toxic aromatics significantly and create demand for billions of additional bushels of corn. The president should direct EPA to enforce Congress's long-neglected directive to reduce the toxic compounds in gasoline by replacing aromatics with cleaner alternatives such as high-octane ethanol. The nation will be meeting its obligation to protect the health and welfare of its citizens. And that article, or guest column, rather, A Larger Market for Iowa Ethanol, was presented by Doug Durante and Doug Somke. And we have two letters to the editor today. The first comes from Jennifer Groff of Clinton, and her letter is entitled, Rita Hart is the Real Deal. This pandemic has prevented some of you from having the face-to-face opportunity to meet with 2nd District Congressional hopeful Rita Hart. But let me tell you, Rita is the real deal. Rita is a thoughtful, intelligent, considerate woman who works tirelessly for Iowans. She has always listened to both sides, gathering information to make educated decisions. She doesn't ask what party you are affiliated with when making determinations or holding listening sessions. She is truly a representative for all of us. Married to Paul and a mother and grandmother, Rita is also a woman of unquestionable Catholic faith. As a healthcare activist, I have seen firsthand how Rita addresses the financial shortcomings provided for the treatment and care of the mentally ill. understanding and fighting against the funding deficiency providers face, Rita is also a compassionate and knowledgeable advocate for equitable access for healthcare. She believes quality, affordable healthcare is a right for all, not for some. Rita will fight for a just solution for healthcare for all Iowans and make sure pre-existing conditions will be protected under any plan. Rita founded the Clinton County Economic Development Coordinating Council for small town mayors to work together to spur economic growth. By working together, the group's efforts will provide an impact for years to come. As a farmer and former teacher, Rita knows cooperation and collaboration is the key to any investment for our future. Please join me in voting for my friend, Rita Hart. And that letter by Jennifer Groff of Clinton. The next letter comes from Jan Patterson of Marion. Her letter is entitled, "The Fate of Social Security is on the Ballot This Year." In Iowa, early voting started on October 5 by absentee in-person voting. Most voters have different ideas of what they want and vote accordingly. I would like to remind everyone that President Donald Trump and Senator Joni Ernst have both stated they want to privatize Social Security. Now, this may not matter if you have a healthy trust fund, but if you were like me, you work for many years adding to the fund for the years when you're not able to work. We need to evaluate what the loss of this security would mean to most of us. If you have any money invested in the stock market, you know the ups and downs that can happen overnight. Remember 2008? I do. I lost half my retirement that I had for years, conscientiously been tucking away until it was gone. I had several more working years to recover, and I was thankful I didn't have to count on what was no longer there. A vacation from paying FICA or FICA payroll taxes sounds really good, until you realize that those funds have to be repaid, and it will be taken out of your paycheck next year. Still sounds good? Those funds pay for Social Security. If you are independently wealthy, this doesn't matter. If you have worked all your life for less than six figures, it should matter. And that letter by Jan Patterson of Marion. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, October the 12th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, from Anamosa, Alice Umdenstock, age 95, of Anamosa, passed away on Sunday, October the 11th. Per her wishes, there will be no viewing or services. A private interment in Rose Hill Cemetery in Mechanicsville. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon is caring for Alice and her family. From Cedar Rapids, David L. Hoagland passed on Friday, October 9, at his home after a year-long battle with cancer. A private service will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, and visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 13, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories State Room. From Cedar Rapids, Judith Ann, also known as Judy Boardman, age 74, died on Saturday, October the 10th, at her home following a lengthy illness. A celebration of life gathering will be held from noon to 4 p.m. Saturday, October 17, at Prairie Creek Christian Church in Benton. A private interment will take place at Lafayette Cemetery in rural Alburnett. The Murdoch-Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted with arrangements. Also from Cedar Rapids, Carol Ann DeBrower, age 83, died peacefully on Friday evening, October 9. An outdoor celebration of life service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 13, at the Brosh Chapel, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family after 10 a.m. Tuesday before the service at the chapel. And from Cedar Rapids, A. Marie Huff died Friday, October 9, at the Mercy Hospice House in Hiawatha after battling leukemia. Graveside services at 3 p.m. Tuesday at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery section, Garden of Tranquility, and family wishes masks to be worn. Per Marie's request, there will be no visitation. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Also from Cedar Rapids, Dean Hartley Gesme Sr. of Cedar Rapids passed away in the loving arms of his dear Savior at the age of 91 on Friday, October 9, after a long and purposeful life. There will be a private family service at First Lutheran Church, and Dean will be laid to rest at the Vermont Lutheran Church Cemetery in Black Earth, Wisconsin. From Cedar Rapids, Shirley M. Tudor, age 83, passed away surrounded by family on Friday, October 9. A private family funeral service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Private burial will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Michael, also known as Mike Hinton, age 49, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Marion, passed away at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids on Friday, October 9, due to complications from COVID-19. A public visitation will be offered at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, October 12. From Hiawatha, Jack Anderson Taylor Sexton, age 87, left his early earthly home to reside in heaven on Saturday, October 10, at the Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital after a short but determined fight with COVID-19. Visitation will be from noon to 1 p.m. Saturday at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Private family services at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. The service will be live streamed on Saturday at 1 p.m. and burial with military rites at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. There will be a visitation on Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. And then from Cedar Rapids, William H., also known as Bill Klein, age 88, died on Friday, October 9, at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Private graveside services will be held at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Newhall, Lenore Ann Senny, age 92, died Friday, October 9, at the Allen Memorial Hospital in Waterloo. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, October 14, at St. John Lutheran Church in Newhall. Visitation will be held at the church from 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. Wednesday. Interment will be held at St. John Cemetery near Newhall. From Cedar Rapids, Norbert H. Neera, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, entered into eternal rest on Friday, October 9, at the Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. A private gathering to celebrate his life will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel State Room. A private graveside service will follow the gathering at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. And from Dyersville, Virgine H. Brockenstedt, age 85, passed away peacefully on Saturday, October 10, at Mercy One Senior Care Center in Dyersville. A private family visitation for Virgine will be held at the Rife Funeral Home in Dyersville. And from Mount Vernon, Arkansas, Richard Martin Waite, age 92, formerly of Lisbon, Iowa, passed away on Friday, October 9, at the South Ridge Village in Heber Springs, Arkansas. A memorial graveside service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, October 14, at the McLeany Cemetery in Higdon, Arkansas. From Cedar Rapids, Hazel I. Aitchison, age 90, passed away peacefully on Saturday, October the 10th, at the Methwick Woodlands in Cedar Rapids. A private family gravesite service will be offered at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery Garden of Tranquility. From Marengo, Betty J. Kopf, age 93, passed away peacefully on Friday, October the 9th, at Rose Haven Nursing Home. A celebration of life services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, October 14, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Burial will be in Cedar Memorial Cemetery. A visitation will be 1 hour before services on Wednesday at Brosh Chapel. And in other death notices today from Cedar Rapids, Rose E. Caraway, age 81, died Thursday, October the 8th. The Iowa Cremation of Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Central City, Blake Beckman, age 46, died Friday, October 9. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City is helping with arrangements. From Dunkerton, Eileen B. Primer, age 87, died Sunday, October the 11th. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home of Oldwine is assisting the family. And from Keystone, Roger L. Harder, age 84, died Sunday, October the 11th. The Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone is assisting the family. From Manchester, William David Wallace, age 90, died Friday, October 9. The Bonencamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester is helping the family. And from Maquoketa, Agnes Hins, age 92, died Friday, October 9. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. And on today's sports page, a short notice about prep sports. We have a high school volleyball at the Walmack Pool Play at Independence and West Delaware. That's at 4 p.m. And in women's golf, the American Rivers Conference Tournament is in Ames today. And here's the schedule for high school football playoffs. The first round is Friday. Second round is October 23, and all games start at 7 p.m. In Class 4A, the first round of Pod 7, Ottumwa at 0-6 plays at Iowa City High, who is at 1-3. And a bye is the Iowa City West at 4-0. Pod 12, Cedar Rapids Jefferson at 0-7 is at Ames at 1-4. A bye is at Southeast Polk at 6-0. And at state, Davenport West at 0-7, at Davenport Central 1-6. Sioux City West at 0-7 at Council Bluffs Jefferson at 1-5. And byes include Ankeny at 6-1 and Pleasant Valley at 7-0. In the second round, Pod 3 is at Cedar Rapids, Washington at 3-4, at Cedar Falls, who is 4-2. Pod 4, Cedar Rapids Kennedy at 2-3, is at Dubuque Senior at 4-3. In Pod 5, Iowa City Liberty, whose record is 2-2, is at Dubuque Hempstead, whose record is 6-1. Pod 6, Davenport North at 3-3, is at Cedar Rapids Prairie at 4-2. And then Pod 10, Linmar at 1-4 is at Waukee, who is at 5-2. And at state, Marshalltown at 3-4 is at Urbana at 5-1. Sioux City North at 3-4 is at West Des Moines Dowling at 5-1. And West Des Moines Valley, 2-4, is at Council Bluffs Lincoln at 5-2. And Ankeny Centennial at 1-5. Is at Sioux City East at 6-1. And Fort Dodge at 3-4 is at Waterloo West at 3-4. Muscatine at 3-4 is at Bettendorf at 4-2. And Indianola at 3-4 is at Johnston at 3-4. Here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled A Nightly Dinner with Older Sister is Too Much Togetherness. Dear Abby, I'm 25 and live with my parents. My 28-year-old sister lives in a condo about 10 minutes away. She just graduated from school and moved back here, which means she doesn't have many friends in the city. For the past 5 months, she's been coming over for dinner every day and weekend. I still am finding ways to be social during quarantine, but my sister doesn't seem able to find other means to meet people. Seeing this much of her is too much. She demands attention, practically forces us to entertain her, and gets upset when the dinner my parents are cooking doesn't meet her specifications. At her age, spending this much time with your parents seems unhealthy. I'm scared to bring it up because she's hypersensitive. How do I avoid another several months of lockdown with a person who doesn't even live with me? That's signed Overwhelmed in Oregon. And Abby responds, Dear Overwhelmed, this isn't a subject you should address with your sister, but is something to discuss privately with your parents. Whether to draw the line and encourage your sister to become less dependent is something they might want to consider. When her company becomes more than you can handle, excuse yourself, go to your room, and avail yourself of your other ways to be social by firing up your computer and visiting with friends. It would also be a kindness for you to suggest ways that she, too, can spend time with other people. And here are a couple of Eastern Iowa briefs for today. The first one comes from Iowa City, and it's entitled The Iowa City Public Library Bookmobile to Resume Holds Pickup Service Starting Today. The Iowa City Public Library Bookmobile can soon be found again on the streets of Iowa City. Beginning today, the ICPL Bookmobile will be offering hold pickup service at the following community locations. On Mondays, from 10 a.m. to noon at the North Dodge Hy-Vee, and from 3 to 5 p.m. at St. Mark's United Methodist Church. On Tuesdays, it's 10 a.m. to noon at the Waterfront Hy-Vee and 3 to 5 p.m. at Pepperwood Plaza. Wednesdays, it's 10 a.m. to noon at First Avenue Hy-Vee and 3 to 5 p.m. at Mercer Park. Thursdays, from 10 a.m. to noon at Green State Credit Union and from 3 to 5 p.m. at Terry Trueblood. And Fridays, from 10 a.m. to noon at Walmart and 3 to 5 p.m. at Breckenridge Estates. Physical browsing on the mobile library is not yet available. After placing a hold and selecting the bookmobile as a pickup location, once patrons are notified that their holds are on the bookmobile, they can visit the bookmobile at any of the above times and locations. All visitors are required to wear masks and to maintain social distancing. And from Eastern Iowa, HACAP Heating Assistance Program is taking applications from elderly and disabled. Elderly and disabled individuals at or below the federal poverty guidelines now are eligible to apply for the 2020 Low Income Energy Assistance Program facilitated through the Hawkeye Area Community Action Program in Benton, Delaware, Dubuque, Jones, Iowa, Jackson, Johnson, Lynn, and Washington counties. Those who are not elderly or disabled will be eligible to apply November the 1st. For more information, to download an application and see a full list of participating intake sites, visit hacap.org/energy. And the Iowa Ideas Conference is from October 15 to 16. Never has there been a more critical time for Iowans to share their experiences of today to build opportunities for tomorrow. Join us for 2 days of idea sharing, along with local and national speakers. This event, hosted by the Gazette, is free to all, but registration is required. Full schedule and registration is available now at iowaideas.com. Also from the community page, a grant to help University of Iowa spread programs. This is an article by Allison Goins of the Gazette staff. A collaboration between 4 University of Iowa-based institutions will soon help bring their programming to wider audiences who can't access them during the pandemic. The Stanley Museum of Art, the Office of the State Archaeologist, the Pentagrist Museums, and the University Libraries are partnering on the project, which secured a $200,327 grant to expand their senior programming in Southeast Iowa. The money will be used to digitize collections from the 4 institutions and to create virtual events that senior living facilities can do with their residents. They also will record events such as talks with scholars or art projects. The recordings will be available to access anytime online. We have about 4 million objects in our collection, said Elizabeth Reitz, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Office of the State Archaeologist. We'll be taking high-quality images of a lot of our objects and writing interpretation and question guides that can go with them. We have a lot of photographs digitized, but haven't had the time and money to really ramp up digitizing objects before now. The Pentagrest and UI libraries are getting special cameras to do 3D tours of their galleries. She's already been doing digital outreach during the pandemic, holding online lectures and discussions with archaeologists. This will be a chance to expand that effort. Since the pandemic, we've all been dabbling in this. It's been a really short time to learn new ways of engagement and outreach, she said. Before, my office in particular spent a lot of time traveling to give in-person and classroom classes, and that all stopped. The grant is funded by the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or the CARES Act, which set aside money for museums and libraries responding to the coronavirus pandemic. The grant also will help pay salaries for project staff whose jobs were jeopardized by the economic fallout of the pandemic. The UI grant, titled Connected for Life, Object-Based Digital Programming to Foster Active Minds for Senior Living Communities, started as an idea to expand the Stanley Museum of Art's Senior Living Communities program, which has been around for several years. Program coordinator Amanda Lensing said that before the pandemic, she was taking art programs to 17 senior living communities monthly and worked with 25 to 30 senior living groups in 4 counties. Even after the pandemic ends, this grant will help them reach more people. It was at capacity. We had a waiting list. Now, virtually, we can reach anyone, she said. They are starting with a needs assessment survey of senior living communities, and then we'll start building the online portal. Lensing said a key concern is making the material accessible, which will mean making sure the videos are closed captioned, as an example. She said having access to programs like this is always important, and even more so during the pandemic. Even pre-pandemic, just on a normal day, there's still isolation and loneliness, and people whose families might not be near them to visit, she said. Programming in general is good for stimulation and engagement. It helps with that isolation and sense of connection that's so needed for all of us, but especially for aging adults. And we have a theater review story entitled TCR Brings Hypnotic Horror Story to Bruce Moore. It's an article by Diana Nolan of the Gazette staff. Don't let the title fool you. St. Nicholas is no Christmas pageant, but it is a great and wondrous gift to audiences, actors, and everyone working behind the scenes in this Theater Cedar Rapids Bruce Moore collaboration. Presented under the stars in Bruce Moore's courtyard, accessed from Linden Drive Southeast, the show continues Wednesday through Saturday. I caught Friday's sold-out performance on a perfect summery fall evening. With physically distanced seating for 81, including 18 tables and 9 single chairs, don't wait to grab your ticket or you'll miss out on a most intriguing tale of lust run amok and vampires. 'Tis the Halloween season, after all. Last year, Matthew James, one of the corridor's finest actors, created the most terrifying evening of theater I've ever witnessed, portraying Dracula in Theater Cedar Rapids' Brandon Studio. This year, he's sinking his teeth into the other side of darkness. His unnamed character is a middle-aged, overweight, booze-soaked theater critic who delights in the power he wields over actors who quake when they hear he's in their midst. That's pretty much the only delight he finds in his life outside of Dublin's pubs, and a glimmer of affection for his daughter, who may follow in his footsteps as a writer. His son just siphons his money, and his wife siphons his soul, all of which leaves him feeling dead inside. Then one night, he's bewitched by a young actress named Helen, who is dancing the role of Salome in a show he pans. He feels so bad about his negative review that he follows her to London to apologize and see her again. She has awakened something inside him. Here is where director Angie Thomson's brilliance comes into play. The award-winning script from Irish playwright Connor McPherson is intended as a solo performance, but Thomson brings on board Anna Slife as Helen and several other characters, adding an elegant, hypnotic visual dimension in the ethereal, gauzy shadows of S. Benjamin Farrar's elegant hypnotic scenery and lighting effects. James has proved his mettle time after time. For me, beginning with Angels in America in 2007, and thereafter from Tour de Force turns in Hamlet, Doubt, and the Summerland Project to St. Nicholas. He slips in and out of this show's various characters and accents with ease, so audiences are never left wondering who is speaking. As the critic, he moves with an arthritic posture in his knees and hips, with pot-bellied back pain. But when he voices the vampire he meets in London, he becomes instantly urbane. Thomson described the show as enigmatic, and indeed it is, whether by her choices or as dictated by the script. At first, James' high-buttoned three-piece suit led me to believe the action was set at the turn of the 20th century. But then his character mentioned being on radio and television and ringing his review from his car, placing him squarely in the 21st century. A little twist near the end of the show blurs those lines in a most delicious, barely perceptible way. When I asked Thomson about the significance of the play's title, she offered up one theory. The only holiday reference to Christmas is his line, "You can't light a stranger's face with the mention of Santa. You can only do that to certain people and for a certain amount of time." He's talking about our need for vampires to be magical. Something in us craves the supernatural, Thomson said. But more symbolically, St. Nicholas calls up the critic's genuine feeling for his daughter, which stops him in his tracks and diverts his cynicism several times. James is a mesmerizing storyteller. He's physically and emotionally raw as his character stumbles through life in this horror story where the evil is ordinary, making it much more frightening. Thank you, TCR and Bruce Moore, for slaking our thirst for live theater, showing us that it is indeed undead. And if you go, it's at the Theater Cedar Rapids and Bruce Moore, who presents St. Nicholas by Connor McPherson. It's at Bruce Moore's Outdoor Courtyard at 2160 Linden Drive Southeast in Cedar Rapids. It's at 7 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday, and the runtime is 85 minutes with one intermission. Seating is 18 tables of 4 and 9 single seats. The content is advisory is adult language and themes. The tickets, the tickets are $100 per table and $25 for individual seats. Available through the TCR box office at 319-366-8591 or theatercr.org/event/ stnicholas/2020-10-09. The parking is on site. You enter through Linden Drive gates and exit via Dowse Lane. There is no parking along Dowse Lane. And extra chairs are provided. Face masks and social distancing is mandatory. Hand sanitizer is on site, and you can bring your own beverage and snacks. And for you gardeners in the audience, we have an article called Digging for Dinosaurs, an article by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette staff. Poisonous plants once thought to have killed the dinosaurs are growing in Iowa. Before scientists agreed dinosaurs likely died after a giant asteroid hit Earth, there were theories dinosaurs died from eating poisonous plants. A study published in 2018 shows dinosaurs just couldn't learn by taste which foods were toxic. Humans also have to be careful about poisonous plants. There are several that could make you sick, said John Pearson, a botanist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. If you eat enough of them, you can actually die. Some of the poisonous plants in Iowa include mushrooms, such as the Amanita, and false morels, he said. Another mushroom that would be fun to see but not eat would be the jack-o'-lantern mushroom, which is orange and glows at night. This mushroom can cause stomach cramps, vomiting, and diarrhea. Iowa has three plants considered poisonous because they cause an allergic skin reaction. The most well-known is poison ivy, which has bunches of three leaflets and can grow close to the ground or climb up tree trunks. If you brush up against poison ivy, the oil can cause itching, burning, and even blisters that show up in 12 to 24 hours. That's why it's important to wash your skin with soap and water if you think you might have touched the plant. The second poisonous plant in Iowa is wild parsnip, a tall plant with lacy yellow-green heads that often grows in ditches in the summer. If oil from wild parsnip gets on your skin and then you go out in the sun, painful blisters can develop. The last poisonous plant is the stinging nettle, which has tiny acid-filled needles that can inject their poison into your skin. Fortunately, the reaction to stinging nettle only lasts a few minutes. One surprising thing about stinging nettles is that you can boil them, which softens and removes the needles, and make them into soup. Wild parsnip also has an edible root, Pearson said. A poisonous plant can be both poisonous to the touch and have parts that are good to eat, he said. If you want to get into edible wild plants, you need to be aware of the edible ones and the poisonous ones. And we have a retiree story. It's entitled Retiree Balanced Needs of Farmers, Hunters, and Critters. This is a story by Rob Barshart of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa just lost another endangered species, a longtime public servant who was nationally recognized in his field. Dale Garner, a longtime leader in the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and a nationally recognized wildlife expert, called it quits last month after roaming the fields, forest farms, and sometimes treacherous halls of state government for more than 25 years. I was always interested in conservation, said Garner, a Wisconsin native who studied in California, New York, and Canada before settling in Iowa. I came here and I stayed because I really enjoyed it. Iowa has a lot to offer. His time in Iowa started with a southern Iowa pheasant hunting trip with a college acquaintance and continued with a long sojourn of balancing the interests of hunters, conservationists, farmers, businesses, and myriad critters, as he calls them, while ensuring habitat for all. After that hunting trip, Garner said he finished his doctoral work in environmental and forest biology on a Friday and the following Monday got a job offer that brought him back to Iowa. Immediately after accepting his Iowa assignment, offers flowed in from Canada and Alaska. But he chose the Midwest to stay close to his grandmother. He described her as a very important part of my life growing up, after his parents died when he was young. After living on the West Coast and the East Coast, I just love the people in the Midwest because they're down to earth. They're so polite and cordial, he said. I enjoyed growing up in this part of the world, and I just enjoyed my working with really down-to-earth people. Garner said he also was drawn to Iowa's rich conservation heritage. Before retiring on September 30, Garner spent most of his career in the DNR's Wildlife Bureau. He began as a research biologist for a forest wildlife species in the Sheraton office in 1995 before moving to Des Moines in 2001 to become the coordinator of the North American Wetland Conservation Act programs and other special projects that included heading up the Chronic Wasting Disease Program. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, October the 12th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thank you for listening.